and welcome to Mound Money on this blustery Monday morning. I'm Doug Wells. I'm here with Roger Goldman. Good morning, Roger. How was your weekend?
My weekend was excellent, although, you know, I was kind of hoping for golf this weekend, and unfortunately the slopes aren't open, so I don't know what we're going to do.
We got a couple more weeks. Boy, this is maybe one of the earlier storms since I've been here, though that said, I do remember snow in September in the past as well.
I also remember a Park City High School football game in mid-October where I was sitting with my family in the snow as my poor kid was trying to play the tuba in the snow. Anyway, so it goes in mid-October. It's one of the things we love about this place.
Always fun dealing with the snow. I remember playing football as well. It's a lot more fun watching a football game in the snow than it is playing the football game in the snow. But enough about the weather. We've got a great show for us for you today. Our first guest is a New York Times author,
Benjamin.
Benjamin Applebaum. And he's written a book called The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society.
The role of government in the economy of the United States grew dramatically in the second half of the 20th century. The booms and busts of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, followed by the dramatic downturn of the Great Depression, left Americans with relatively little faith in markets to control economic destiny.
Enter John Maynard Keynes, a consensus that prosperity and overall economic well-being are dependent on an active role for government in the nation's economy. And it was incumbent on economists, much more so than lawyers, to provide the government with the tools necessary to make appropriate judgments on which macroeconomic levers to pull, what type of regulations to impose, and how every other aspect of government would be affected by economic considerations.
But then in the 1970s, a new breed of economists who believed passionately in the power of markets began to make their marks on both academia and government. Today, we're lucky to be joined by Benjamin Applebaum, the lead writer on business and economics for the editorial page of the New York Times. In the introduction of his fascinating new book, The Economist's Hour, Applebaum writes, "In the four decades between 1969 and 2008, economists played a leading role in curbing taxation and public spending, deregulating large sectors of the economy, and clearing the way for globalization. Economists persuaded Richard Nixon to end military conscription. Economists persuaded the federal judiciary largely to abandon the enforcement of antitrust laws. Economists even persuaded the government to assign a dollar value to human life, around $10 million in 2019, to determine whether regulations were worthwhile." We're fortunate to have Mr. Applebaum with us to discuss the surprisingly interesting characters that practice the dismal science, the policy debates they engaged in, and how their theories have resulted in policy decisions, often with unexpected results. Good morning, Mr. Applebaum, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me.
So can we start by just, can you tell us a little bit about what caused you to write the book and how long did it take?
So I've been covering economic policy for the better part of two decades now, and I got really interested in the history of it, how this world that we live in had been constructed, how those decisions had been made. And as I learned more and more about it, what I learned is that, you know, a lot of the rules we live by are pretty recent. This is the story of a revolution that begins in the late 1960s and the early 1970s, where economists really begin to persuade policymakers to embrace markets as the best system for allocating resources or figuring out who should serve in the military. A whole wide range of decisions are turned over to the markets. And that just fascinated me. It's a story I think a lot of people don't know, and I wanted to tell it.
Yeah, let's take a step back. You mentioned that economics are the rules that the economy are driven by. But rules is a strong word. It's really not rules. It's the theories. And sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. How does that play a role when economists are giving advice to how the government should be run?
Yeah, so it is important to distinguish between two things. Economists have theories about how the economy works. And those theories inform the rules that get written, the laws that get written. So the influence of economists has been in taking those theories and turning them into laws. So to take one of the first examples in this period, economists convinced the federal government during the Nixon administration to abandon a system in which the United States negotiated the value of the dollar with other nations, and it was essentially determined by bureaucrats in Washington, and to move to a system where the exchange value of the dollar was determined by trading on the open market. So that's a theory about the best way to determine the value of a currency that is then translated into a change in the rules.
And let's talk a little bit about that. The issue was what they called Bretton Woods, which was the prior regime under which international currency was regulated. How did that work, and why was the decision made to change to a more market-oriented approach?
The whole idea that economists or that governments can manage economic growth is really pretty new. When the Great Depression hits the United States in the 1930s, the federal government isn't even sure how large the American economy is. And they hire a guy named Simon Kuznets to figure that out, and it takes him about 2 years, and he comes back and says, well, the economy used to be this big, and now it's quite a bit smaller. And that's really that's the basis of what we call GDP, gross domestic product, the measurement, the familiar measurement of how large the economy is and how fast it's growing. And only once you have that idea in hand do people start thinking about, well, now that we know how large the economy is, we can manage its growth. And so after World War II, the federal government begins to develop elaborate bureaucracies to manage the economy and treaties. And one of those systems is the Bretton Woods Agreement, which is basically designed to facilitate global trade by fixing the value of currencies so that you can be confident that when your goods get to London, you know exactly how much a pound is going to be worth in dollars. And that system and similar systems for managing economic growth remain in place for, you know, about 30 years, from, say, 1945 to the mid-1970s. It's a period where there's just a lot of confidence in the ability of people to manage economics and to regulate the marketplace. And that system begins to break down, and we can talk about that. But that's the origins of the Bretton Woods system.
It seems kind of obvious that economists should play a major role in thinking about international currency. It's not as obvious that economists would play a major role in evaluating whether or not this country should maintain conscription or the draft. And yet, early in the book, you discuss the role of economists in President Nixon's decision to end the draft. Can you sort of discuss how economic considerations should have played a role in that decision?
Yeah, it's really a fascinating story and one that I think is unfamiliar to a lot of people. Basically, you know, in this same period from the end of World War II through the early 1970s, the government is deciding who is going to serve in the armed forces. There's every year tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of young men are selected and required to serve in the military. And this is part of this broader sense that government is best equipped to make these kinds of decisions. So there are draft boards in every community that are deciding who should go and serve. And economists begin to argue that this is not a good way to make those decisions, that what you end up doing if you're just picking people is you bring Elvis Presley into the military, and Sergeant Elvis Presley is serving for 2 years. And actually, we'd all be better off if Elvis Presley could pursue his singing career and someone else could decide that they want to be in the military. The argument is basically if you pay people whatever amount is required to convince them to serve, you'll be making sure that the people who want to serve are serving and the people who want to do other things are doing other things. You basically replace the bureaucrats with the marketplace. And Richard Nixon is really compelled by this idea. It really takes hold of his imagination, and it's a big reason that he decides to end the draft in the early 1970s. Economists convince him not only is this better for the economy and for society, but it's also going to be affordable for the military. And so Nixon ends military conscription and replaces it with what we still have to the present day, which is a system of paying people a market rate for their services in the military. And it's fascinating because that's really the first place that economists succeed in reshaping government policy in this way, and it's a totally unexpected place.
So they made a great argument from an economic standpoint, and it's fascinating that this is about the draft. You know, the U.S. is fortunate that we have some of the world's leading economists based here to advise us as a country. Israel also has great economists. They know about this theory as well. Yet they've decided that they're going to do it, maintain the draft in their country. How is it that two countries with access to similar theories, similar data, come to such dramatically different decisions?
Well, I think there's two big things. The first point, obviously, is that the circumstances are very different. One key difference between Israel and the United States is even by the 1960s, the United States military only required a small share of the young men who came of age each year. So of all of the people who turned 18 in the mid-1960s, less than half of them ended up serving in the military, and that number was headed down as the population continued to grow. And so what you were really talking about was a system in which you needed to decide essentially who was going to serve and who wasn't going to serve. In a country like Israel, where they really need everyone to serve, there's a very different calculus in place. But I think there's a broader point as well here, which is that economic decisions are seated in a social context. A society needs to decide what its priorities are. And some countries that have maintained national service requirements, the Netherlands is a great example of this, also don't need everyone to serve in the military, but they've made a social decision that it's important for everyone to participate in some form of social obligation for a couple of years. That is a way of ensuring that everyone is contributing to society, everyone is participating in society, even if it's a little economically inefficient, even if Sergeant Elvis Presley needs to set aside his singing career for a couple of years, society is better off if everyone participates. And so economists can tell you what's most efficient, but a society needs to decide for itself what choices it wants to make.
And we could certainly have a longer discussion about how the lack of conscription may have affected foreign policy choices that might otherwise have been made had a broader section of the population been subject to military service. I wanted to ask you about another chapter in the book, which sounded to me when I first read it as sort of the equivalent of economist superheroes, and that would be Friedman versus Keynes. Let's talk a little bit about who those two people are and what that debate was about.
Yeah, John Maynard Keynes is sort of the dominant figure in economics around the Second World War. He's really the guy who, after economists figure out how to measure the size of the economy, he's the guy who comes forward and says, okay, we can manage this. The discipline of what's called macroeconomics, the idea that government can get its hands around the economy and tweak things and improve things. If there's a recession, the government can spend money. If people aren't spending, the government can step in and do it for them and revive economic growth. This whole confidence that the economy is manageable, and indeed that it needs to be managed, that government has an important role to play in the marketplace, is really the work of John Maynard Keynes and his disciples, and it's really a powerful influence on economic policy in the United States and in other Western democracies in the decades after World War II. And Milton Friedman is the guy who comes along and says, no, Keynes is wrong. And Friedman's a fascinating guy. He grew up during the Great Depression, but unlike many of his contemporaries, he emerged from it convinced that the problem was too much government. He really felt strongly that what the United States and other countries needed to do was to take their hands off of the economy. That he used to joke that if bureaucrats were placed in charge of the Sahara Desert, there'd be a shortage of sand. He really felt that government made everything worse, that markets worked better in the absence of regulation, in the absence of government interference. And he started making that argument, and for decades he was kind of a voice in the wilderness. He was this incredibly charismatic, potent debater. One of his friends joked that it was best to argue with him when he wasn't in the room, because then you might have a chance of winning. But even so, for decades, he didn't make much progress. And it's only in the 1970s that people really begin to listen to Milton Friedman.
And by the way, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book was sort of your personal the observation about the personalities of these people. Things like, you know, Friedman, and I believe it was George Stigler, sharing a $300 car. And you get a perspective on these people that they were people who felt passionately about their intellectual beliefs and were determined to sort of find a way to influence policymakers. And certainly Friedman had an enormous influence. Let's talk a little bit about how that debate between those two is reflected. And I think it might be useful to just do a little bit on what the difference between fiscal and monetary policy as tools are before we get into how they approached it.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, thank you. I mean, this is a book of stories, and it was very much my hope to tell it in a way that would be engaging for people, because not only because I think it matters to understand who these people were, but because, you know, as a journalist, I really believe that stories are the best way of talking about ideas. So fiscal and monetary policy, basically the division is monetary policy, which in the United States is managed by the Federal Reserve, is basically the work of determining how much money is in the economy, of moving interest rates up and down, And fiscal policy is the government's role in determining how to spend that money, how much money to take out of people's pockets in the form of taxes, how much to return to them in the form of government services. And those two things are the great levers that are under the control of the government as it seeks to influence economic conditions. Keynes felt very strongly that fiscal policy was the dominant lever, that the government ought to really focus on its own role as an economic actor, taxing in order to slow economic growth if things were getting out of control, spending to help economic growth if the economy was sputtering and needed help. And Friedman, by contrast, came along and argued that Keynes was all wrong and that really the only thing government could do to help the economy was to focus on the money supply. He called this monetarism, and to make sure that the money supply was increasing at a steady, regular pace. And this was his minimalist prescription for economic policy.
If you're just joining us, our guest this morning, and we're having a fascinating conversation with him, is Benjamin Applebaum. He is the author of The Economist's Hour, False Prophets, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. You know, your book does a great job of highlighting the importance of strong economists as advisors to our government and the impact and the leverage that gives us and impacts all of our lives. You know, I don't know this, but I don't think we've had any presidents that have been economists. We had Jimmy Carter, who was a nuclear engineer. We had Ronald Reagan, who is an actor. Currently, we have a businessman in the running. And if you look at the field on the Democrat side, I believe we have a lot of attorneys, but no economists. Why do you think that is? And do you think that an economist would have some skills that might be useful in the role as president?
So I think that we've seen the role of economists in public life really increasing dramatically. I actually begin the book with the story of a young economist working at the Federal Reserve in the mid-1950s, just doing numbers for the people who actually ran the place. And he comes home one night and tells his wife that he doesn't think there's a future for an economist at the Federal Reserve. He can't imagine ever moving into management because there are no economists in management. It's an amazing story because that guy's name is Paul Volcker, and by the end of the 1970s, he is running the Federal Reserve. And today, the Federal Reserve is the nation's largest employer of economists. We've now had a number of Treasury secretaries who were economists, one Secretary of State, George Shultz. The Fed has been run almost exclusively by economists for the last half century. Many regulatory agencies are either headed by economists or have economists among their senior officials. There's really been this transformation of the role of economists in American government, and that is at the very core of my book. It's true that none of them have become president, but actually the last four Republican presidents were majors in economics as undergraduates. None of them went on to hold a PhD in the subject, but they were all educated in it as undergraduates. And in general, economics education has become a much more prominent part of the college curriculum. Economists have become much more prominent figures in our public discourse. It's true that none of them has quite made it to the presidency yet, and it's interesting to think about how that might look if an economist were president, and we can talk about that. But I want to make sure it's clear that you know, it's sort of an everything but that phenomenon at this point.
And I suppose one way of speculating as to how it might look would be to consider the West Wing, where the fictional president, Jed Bartlett, was in fact an economics professor.
Things worked out so well on that show. There was such less controversy than there is today.
By the end of every episode. You mentioned Volcker, and I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about what happens when Volcker is in charge of the show and he seeks to tame inflation. How did he try to do it, and what was the result?
Yeah, Paul Volcker takes control of the Fed in the late 70s. Jimmy Carter turns to him because the economy is in bad shape. And this really, the 70s are sort of this decisive turning point. You know, economists are losing faith in their ability to manage the economy. I write about a woman named Juanita Kreps, who was the Commerce Secretary in the Carter administration. And she was also a professor of economics at Duke University. She was a Keynesian. And she resigned from the Carter administration in the late 1970s because she said she had lost confidence in the ability of government to help the economy. And she also resigned from Duke University because she said she didn't know what to teach her students anymore. And that's really where, you know, mainstream economics was by the late 1970s. There was a crisis of confidence. People had lost faith in their ability to do the things that they thought they knew how to do. And it's into that void that the ideas of Milton Friedman really come, that policymakers begin turning to him and saying, okay, you've said all along that you have a different way of doing things. We need a different way of doing things. You know, tell us what to do. And one of Friedman's big ideas, probably his most influential, is that the central bank should focus exclusively on getting inflation under control, and it should do that by restricting the money supply. It should really just squeeze the economy as hard as it needed to in order to break the back of inflation. And that's exactly what Paul Volcker does. He goes out there on a Saturday night and holds a press conference, which at the time was an unheard-of thing for a Federal Reserve chairman to do, and he basically says, we're declaring war on inflation, we'll drive interest rates as high as we need to, we're going to make this stop. And the economy plunges into a deep recession during the early years of Ronald Reagan's tenure, and then revives and comes out of it, and the Fed keeps inflation under control. And to the present day, we haven't really had a revival of inflation. So in that sense, Paul Volcker and his successors are enormously successful in bringing inflation under control. The trade-off is that they tolerated higher unemployment. They allowed millions of Americans to stay out of work in the service, they thought, of keeping inflation as low as possible. And that's sort of at the very core of what happens during the Economist's Hour is this trade-off where this overriding focus on efficiency and making markets work as well as possible really comes at the expense, in many ways, of ordinary Americans.
One of the other figures that comes into play during the early 1980s is, of course, Arthur Laffer. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about who he was and how his theories played into public policy, particularly during the Reagan administration.
Laffer's a fascinating guy. He's one of the great characters in this book, and fortunately he's still with us, still alive and lively and enjoying life. Laffer is an economist who joins the faculty at the University of Chicago in the mid-1960s and becomes a leading proponent for the idea that the biggest problem confronting the economy is that taxes are too high. And if you can just reduce tax rates, you will unleash creativity and investment and economic growth. And he makes this case. He's a wonderful sort of salesman. He's this lively guy. For years, he used to keep a parrot who would sometimes sit on his shoulder during interviews. He's a character and very persuasive. And he really begins to influence Republican policymakers, in part because he's telling them something they very much want to hear, which is, listen, if you go out there and advocate for lower taxes, that's not irresponsible. That's not going to blow a hole in the federal budget. That's going to be good for the economy. Well, actually, he argues that if you reduce tax rates, the government will actually collect more money in revenues because there'll be such a boom in economic growth that everyone will benefit. And this is a tremendously appealing message. And the Republican Party really begins to embrace it as the core of its fiscal prescription for the economy. And not just Laffer, but Laffer and a number of his allies really succeed in convincing the Reagan administration to really embrace this. And so Reagan comes in, and his first big piece of public policy is a huge tax cut, which he says is going to revive economic growth. Well, it completely fails to work. Laffer's ideas are wrong. It doesn't actually succeed in increasing investment. It doesn't succeed in bringing in more revenues. It causes a giant budget deficit. But the politics are so appealing that Republicans keep going back to this well. And so in 2001, we get the second great Laffer supply-side tax cut under George W. Bush. And 2 years ago, we got the third one under Donald Trump. So it's an idea with tremendous sticking power, even though the available evidence suggests that it's not right.
And perhaps folks that should know better maybe do know better, but they want to pretend they don't know better so that they can reduce taxes and get more money in their pocketbooks. You finish your book talking about the financial crisis and kind of the roles that some economists that had gone before had played in that. And it highlights the point that economics is not a science. In fact, you know, people think about the Nobel Prize in economics. When I went to business school, several of my professors had run Nobel Prizes. But there is no Nobel Prize in economics. There's a Nobel Memorial Prize. And that was done on purpose because the Nobel family, when they established this, recognized that economics was not a hard science. It was theories. And they didn't want to give too much power by recognition of the Nobel Prize. Later on, they did introduce something called the Nobel Memorial Prize. But it talks about that it's not a hard science, that as you mentioned with the previous example, sometimes you try things and it works, sometimes you try things and it doesn't. One of the bigger mistakes that had happened and excesses taking place was the financial crisis we all lived through in 2008, 2009. You conclude your book with that story. Share with our listeners a few of the more interesting points that you make in that chapter.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's best to think economics was originally called political economics. That was the name of the field. And what that really captures is that economics is fundamentally part of the political process. It's a way of disciplining our discussions about political choices, of evaluating costs and benefits, of thinking about trade-offs. It's an enormously useful discipline, but it exists in a political context. And in the years before the financial crisis, what you had was prominent economists, probably the most important of whom was Alan Greenspan, arguing that markets should be left unregulated, that the government's interference in the marketplace produced worse outcomes than just stepping back and allowing market participants to work it out amongst themselves. And he was, at the time, the nation's leading financial regulator. He was the chairman of the Federal Reserve. He had taken an oath to regulate the nation's financial systems, and he says that he had in mind, even as he took the oath of office, that he didn't mean it, because in his view, regulation was counterproductive. And so you get this remarkable period in which the people in Washington who are supposed to be watching the financial system and supervising it are instead actively engaged in taking apart those regulations and telling each other that this is a good thing. And not just taking apart existing regulations, but refusing to regulate new markets, one of the most important of which is the marketing credit derivatives. It's basically a form of gambling on the movement of other prices. And it emerges in the early 1990s in a big way. And there are some people who are smart enough to say, hey, new marketplace, we need new rules. And the response is basically, keep your hands off of it. This is a pristine space that hasn't been muddled by government bureaucrats, and we need to keep it that way. And a guy named Phil Graham, a senator from Texas, actually writes a law prohibiting the government from regulating this exciting new marketplace. His wife, Wendy Graham, is one of the leading regulators of that marketplace. But again, when we say regulator, we mean at this time a person who is not doing any regulation. And the result is that things go crazy. And we all know what happens at the end of the story, which is that the markets do not actually do a good job of regulating themselves. The excesses mount, and the financial system almost comes crashing down, and we, the taxpayers, are forced to bail out these giant financial institutions. And the core point here, which is really important and sort of undergirds the whole book, is that markets are human creations. They don't exist in a state of nature. They are created by governments. They have rules. Those rules will either be written intelligently or they will exist by default, but there is no market without government. We have a role to play in deciding what outcomes we want from our markets and in regulating them intelligently to ensure those outcomes. And when we abandon those responsibilities, things can go really wrong.
We've been talking to Binyamin Applebaum, and it's been a fascinating discussion, and I, for one, would like to continue to chat about regulation of the airline industry, public policy in Chile, the economic analysis of Bork and Posner and how it affected antitrust enforcement. But I'm afraid people are going to have to get Mr. Applebaum's book to find out about those topics because we're out of time. Thank you so much for spending part of the morning with us.
That was a fascinating conversation. Really had a lot of fun talking to those authors. We want to thank our great sponsors for the show because we couldn't do a show like this. We couldn't bring a quality program to you each and every Monday morning without our sponsors. They include Mountain West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
And we would also like to thank those great guests we had today, Binyamin Applebaum of the New York Times, talking about his new book, The Economist's Hour, False Profits, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society.